This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
In Canada, you don't have the right to clean air. You don't have the right to clean water. A lot of Canadians think we do have these things. They think it must be somewhere in the legal system, but it's not. If you, Erica, were to go out and see somebody dumping toxic waste in a stream, if you don't have some property relationship with the stream, you don't have standing in the court to do anything about it. But if Mother Nature has rights, then any citizen has not only the right, but the obligation to take action in situations like that.
Hello and welcome to Habitat. I'm your host, Erica Butler, here with you for the next hour of conversations about how we live in our environment. Today on Habitat, a conversation with journalist Silver Donald Cameron, who tells us about his new project looking at the burgeoning movement for environmental rights in North America. You may know Silver Donald Cameron from his distinguished career as a journalist, which he continues today in a variety of projects. He produced and presented the documentary film Salmon Wars, and he runs thegreeninterview.com, featuring interviews with a wide range of thinkers, politicians, activists, all focusing on sustainability. His latest project is greenrights.com, a multimedia project looking at the idea of incorporating the right to a healthy environment in our civil rights. Welcome, Donald.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the genesis of the Green Rights Project. Where did the idea come from?
Well, there's an intimate relationship between the Green Interview and the Green Rights Project. And the Green Rights Project, I can say almost to the minute when it began, and it began across the street at the law school at Dalhousie, at a presentation by Dr. David Boyd about environmental rights. And David has written a couple of books upon the subject, the Right to a Healthy Environment and also the Environmental Rights Revolution, which is a survey of the state of environmental rights in countries around the world. So I listened to David's presentation, and we had booked an interview with him for the next day. But as I listened to him, I realized that the whole business of environmental rights is like the unified field theory of environmentalism. It's the one thing I know that, you know, reaches across practically every environmental issue. For example, if Mother Nature has the right to be respected and protected, as she does in most countries in the world, then you don't have to have a Fisheries Act, for example, to go out and say you cannot pollute this stream. That's just part of the rights of Mother Nature. So you can take action on almost any of these things, and on many of them you wouldn't have standing as an individual. I mean, if you, Erica, were to go out and see somebody dumping toxic waste in a stream, if you're not an owner of some property on the stream, or if you don't have some property relationship with the stream, you don't have standing in the court to do anything about it. But if Mother Nature has rights, then any citizen has not only the right, but the obligation to take action in situations like that. So that's kind of the ultimate environmental right. The other one is your right to a healthy environment. So in Canada and in 15 other countries, you don't have the right to clean air. You don't have the right to clean water. A lot of Canadians think we do have these things. They think it must be somewhere in the legal system, but it's not. If you're in 177 other countries around the world, you do have that right, and you can take action on that basis. So, for example, if someone pollutes the water from which you're going to have to drink, as has happened, for example, in the Ecuadorian Amazon, in 500,000 hectares, there is no potable water. That's an affront to your rights. So you can take that to court and take action against it. We don't have any of that in Canada, and I think we should. And I think once this Harper government is gone, we'll be looking around and saying, what do we do to restore some of the environmental legislation that he's stripped from us? And I think this would be a very good way to solve a whole bunch of those problems at once. So that's that long-winded answer is the final reason for doing this project. It's not just about making a film. It's not just about solving this problem or that problem environmentally. It's about addressing about changing the culture of the country, changing the rights of the citizens of the country, and because it's such a big country, changing the world.
I actually went to David Boyd's talk, too. I can remember that talk very well.
Gorgeous. Wasn't it brilliant?
Yes. Yeah. Well, yeah. You're right in that it was really kind of one of those, the idea just sort of popped and you realized, well, this is a real fundamental thing that would make so many other things possible, if you had it. Why do you think it is that, the state of the world being, like you mentioned, there's, you know, what, 170 countries?
177, I think, yeah.
That have some form of environmental rights in their Charter of Rights. Why is it such a foreign concept here? Or maybe the question I should ask is, how did it come about in all those other countries? What is the cultural thing that brought it about? I mean, in South America, Central America, it's a lot more common.
Oh, it's very big. We've just come back from a trip to Buenos Aires, Quito, and Lima, pursuing this whole subject. And yeah, there have been some fantastic actions taken as a result of having those rights.
What is it about South American countries? Why do the people sort of have that right there, whereas here we kind of, you know, we...
Well, you know, it's not foreign here, but you and I are foreign here. That right, that whole way of looking at the world is the indigenous way of looking at the world. In almost every indigenous culture that I know around the world, there is this sense of reverence about Mother Earth as being our sustainer, being the source of our existence, and is needing to be treated, with great respect. So I, one of the people in the Green Interview is a guy that hasn't often been heard of in the wider culture. His name is Edmund Matachawaban. He's at Peterbeck on James Bay. And he's old enough that he can remember what it was like before the residential schools came along, because they were, well out in the woods, and nobody was paying much attention to them. So he remembers the traditional way of life up until he was 8. He lived that way. And it contains all kinds of things that seem very natural and very normal, but are not part of the Western European culture. For example, as you went up the Albany River, the Fort Albany River, as it's now called, each clan had owned one of the tributaries, or in effect, had that was their territory. Own is not the word; it was more like that was their habitat. Mm-hmm. And they did not go up those tributaries, and others couldn't go up those tributaries, except in occasions of real demonstrated need, because they did not want those tributaries polluted. That wouldn't have been their word for it, but that was the essence of it, that Mother Nature required that those streams be kept clean and pure, and so you should stay out of them. Well,
they had their own watershed protection regulations.
Absolutely. And on the West Coast, for example, the natives out there took only the salmon that were going up their river. So they would have net traps on the banks of the rivers. And they would allow large numbers of salmon to go up, but they'd take enough for themselves. And that was the key. They understood the term enough. Western culture doesn't understand that. And the contrast can be seen in the way that the fish have disappeared on both coasts. Because in BC, for example, every one of those salmon, and here too, every one of those salmon has a particular river and a particular tributary, and a special place that they actually breed. Well, if you catch them at sea, and if you catch them in large numbers as they're moving up and down the coast, you don't know where they came from. So it's quite possible that you would have some little creek that had only maybe half a dozen salmon going back to it every year, and you could wipe out that run with one net and never know it, right? Mm-hmm. But the natives knew better. So I think a lot of this is not so much changing things, it's going back to what we as human beings used to know, and many human beings still do, which brings you to South America, because those are countries where there are Aboriginal majorities in many cases, and in some cases really important Aboriginal presence in government. For example, the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, is himself Aboriginal. And I think he's the first Aboriginal president of any country in North or South America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's interesting. It's almost like colonialism in North America was actually like more successful in stamping out or, in replacing the systems that were here. So, whereas in South America, larger Aboriginal populations and just more of it survived their colonialist experience.
Yeah, well, more of them survived, I guess. This is probably the beginning of all of that. But this understanding of things is still here. I mean, we still mm-hmm. have a very significant native population. We have made many treaties with it, all of which we've broken, and continue to do that. I mean, we've continued to float their rights, but really, the environmental rights are there in indigenous law. And we have on the Green Interview a wonderful guy named John Burrows, who is Anishinaabeg, I always have trouble with that one, from Northern Ontario, now teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. But he's written two books on Aboriginal law. And his point is that because of the treaties, Aboriginal law is still part of the Canadian legal system, and what we need to be doing is recognizing it as a third pillar of the law, along with the common law in English Canada, the civil law in French Canada, and then the Aboriginal law as the third one. So in a way, these things are already there. We need to fan the flame and make them burn a little brighter.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about your recent work in South America. There's a lot happening there in terms of the environmental rights movement.
Yeah, and we can come back and talk a bit about our whole approach to making documentaries, which is we've come to refer to that as being like a peer doc, where the documentary rests on pilings of deep individual interviews, but the documentary itself takes little snippets from them and stitches them together to make the. Now, actually, I have talked about that. So we can.
But what appear as in P-I-E-R, as
yeah,
in like a,
yeah,
a,
that's
a
right.
dock.
Oh, we okay. sometimes call it a dock. You know, it stands on a whole. There's a deck standing on a bunch of pilings. Well, the deck is the documentary, and the pilings are these great interviews that in most projects get neglected, but not for us. Mm-hmm. We move them over onto the website.
Yeah.
But to go back to your actual question.
Okay.
The green interview is. This is where I make a plug for support for anyone who's listening and thinks this project is important, go to greenrights.com. It's all one word, greenrights.com. And there is a trailer there and some more information, but there's also a place that you can contribute financially, and we do need that. And we have raised for that project less than the amount it would be required to buy a Volkswagen. Mm-hmm. But that's been enough to buy some airfares and hotel bills. And what was going on in South America was the second meeting of the Global Alliance for the Rights of Nature that brings together environmental rights advocates from all over the world. And we realized this was a unique opportunity. So we got Cormac Cullinan from South Africa, who wrote the book Wild Law. We got Michelle Maloney from Australia. We got Mumta Ito from Britain. We've a whole array of people all brought together in Quito for 4 or 5 days. So what an opportunity. So that was what determined us to go there. But we also knew about a terrific story in Ecuador, which basically is a lawsuit by indigenous people against Chevron Texaco, which had polluted all these many, many hectares of the Amazon forest. And the leading person there is a guy named Pablo Fajardo. Pablo is a young Aboriginal lawyer in his mid-30s, and on behalf of his people, he and some associates took on this environmental lawsuit, sued for reparations for the damage to their environment, and won a $9.5 billion settlement at the Supreme Court of Ecuador. Chevron then said, well, we're not paying that, and we're out of the country, and so nya.
They just left Ecuador and so
they left $250.
So even the government of Ecuador couldn't seize anything. They were just gone.
They left $250 in their bank account, and that's all there is left of Chevron in Ecuador. So the Ecuadorians, Pablo and his defendants or plaintiffs, have sued in other countries where Chevron does have sufficient assets, and one of those countries is Canada. And I'm happy to say that the Appeal Court of Ontario has agreed that the case can be heard here. Chevron had argued, of course, that they're an American corporation and the whole thing is in Ecuador, so what's Canada got to do with it? But the Canadian courts have agreed to hear it, so that was fabulous. So we went to see Pablo Fajardo and do an interview with him, drove over the Andes to the Amazon, a 6-hour ride in a Quito taxi, of all things, and did that interview. And now have a whole chunk of the Green Rights film that will be built around that case. And another chunk will be built around the one in Argentina, the Riachuelo case. And this is a river that's been polluted since the Spaniards settled there and built tanneries on its banks in the 16th century. And it was counted as the 8th most polluted place in the world by one account. And there's a lawyer there named Daniel Salaberry, who on behalf of a group of citizens who live on the riverbank and who are subjected to toxic wastes and air pollution, emissions, all kinds of stuff, went to court and said, this is an offense to the environmental rights of the people, but it's also an offense to Mother Nature, and the government has to order that it be cleaned up. So he was suing 3 levels of government and 44 industries. And the Supreme Court agreed. And the Supreme Court said, not only should this be done, but we are going to see that it's done. So we are ruling that the governments must set up an independent agency to do the cleanup. They must set out a timetable, a schedule, a plan of work. We will approve that. and then they will do it. And if they fall behind the time points that they've put in their own work plan, we will fine them on a daily basis. This is the Supreme Court just actually taking the helm on all of this. So the transformation in the river has been quite spectacular in the parts where it's been done. This is I think this was a 2008, if I remember rightly, ruling. So 4 years later, there's been some spectacular progress. Still lots to do, but some spectacular progress. Mm. Well, that's what environmental rights can do. And nice to have that for an act in the Green Rights Project. So we've got all of it. We've got the people there. On film, we've got Daniel Salaberry at great length. We've got some of the people involved with ACUMAR, which is the organization set up to do the cleanup. We're going to have a wonderful little act just on that story.
That's Silver Donald Cameron. Stay tuned for part two of our conversation on green rights, coming up after this.
When I was a child, my family would travel down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
That's John Prine with Paradise. Now let's get back to my conversation with journalist Silver Donald Cameron, talking about his new project looking at the burgeoning movement for environmental rights in North America. It's interesting the distinction between environmental rights. I guess I haven't really made that distinction in my thinking yet, between having it enshrined as the rights of Mother Nature or the rights of a citizen to have a healthy environment. Mm-hmm. And I almost feel like culturally it's easier to imagine me as a person having a right to have a healthy environment, but giving rights to Mother Nature, wow.
Yeah, but you see, that's because we're the center of the world, right?
Right.
Everything revolves around us. Yeah. Frogs don't have rights. Other species don't have rights. Mm-hmm. Horses, well, to some extent, you know, domesticated animals do. But, you know, trees don't have rights. Rivers don't have rights. We blow the tops off mountains and dump them in the valleys. No, those features don't have rights.
Maybe we just need to incorporate Mother Nature, and then can all be shareholders. Because corporations have rights, and they're also a fictional...
They're a totally imagined, and there's lots of those things. I mean, this is one of the weird things. If you have a situation where upstream you have the Foul Water Paper Company, you know, polluting the river, and downstream you have Feckless Flats, the town that depends on the river for its drinking water, Feckless Flats can sue Foul Water Paper, and they can fight this out in court, and they're both entirely figments of our collective imagination. They don't exist. They're just conventions, you know? But the river has no rights. And the people on the river, as people, have no real rights. And the animals and fish that live in the river and around the river have no rights. And they're all real. I mean, this is, when you think about it, this is cloud cuckoo land, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. At a certain point when you're describing it, it just becomes so common sense. Have you, I mean, in the green rights process, in this journalistic journey that you're on, have you talked to people about, you know, the chances of green rights being enshrined in a country like Canada?
A lot. And among the countries that do not have environmental rights are some big ones like Canada and the United States and Australia and China and Japan, but also such thought leaders as North Korea and Oman and Cambodia and so forth. It's not really a terrific club to belong to. Mm-hmm. But this is very much an issue both here and in those other countries, and particularly in the United States. And in the States, which is perhaps even more difficult than Canada, they're really going at this municipality by municipality on the assumption that if they get enough municipalities in a state, the state will have to flip in this direction, and if they get enough states, the country will flip in this direction. So the city of Pittsburgh has environmental rights built into its legal system. City of Santa Monica has environmental rights built into its legal system. And actually, here in Canada, those rights have been legislated in a couple of provinces, Ontario and Quebec, and I think Nunavut. I'm not sure what the tally is here. And the approach to this is being driven largely by the David Suzuki Foundation and by EcoJustice. And Suzuki is going to do a tour this fall right across the country promoting this and trying to enlist 8 municipalities that will pursue it. And one of those 8 municipalities is Halifax. And
really?
So Suzuki was here in November, did a public presentation and had breakfast with the mayor and various other, you know, his own people, some of his own people and some people from Halifax. I was fortunate to be there. So I think this may very well become not just a national issue, but a municipal issue. And ultimately, because everybody has the same reaction you do, right? I've never heard of this. It seems very strange. 5 minutes later, you're saying, well, this is common sense, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody gets it very quickly. It's not a difficult concept for people to understand. So it may become an issue in Halifax. I hope it is. And Mayor Savage seemed to be quite responsive to it. So who knows? We may get it right here.
As common sense as it does seem, it seems like there would be a lot of resistance from the powers that be, you know, from corporations that
the 1%.
From the 1%, from the corporations that don't want to be liable, you know, that don't want to open themselves up to being sued. Of course, I mean, enshrining the rights in the first place still doesn't mean that everyone has all the money and resources that you need to actually bring cases to court. But I guess that's a slow process that would build.
Well, it depends on it. That's an interesting question. What motivates people and what enables people to take that kind of action? In the Rio Chuelo in Argentina, as far as I can make out, it was primarily one lawyer who felt very strongly about this, realized there was an instrument there, has spent far more time and money on it than he will ever recover, but believed it was important to do and had the support of a small community that was living in this polluted territory. In the case of the Amazon forest in Ecuador, Pablo Fajardo's, they've been supported by a major New York law firm that is taking it on a contingency basis and saying, if you win, we get a piece of the settlement. Well, if the settlement is $9.5 billion, a small piece of that is a substantial amount of money.
Yes.
So
I hope it's a very small piece.
Well, I'm not. Yes, I'm sure it will be a very small piece of it. But I'm not averse to having those guys make some real money out of it, because they have been fighting that for 20 years alongside the Ecuadorian people in the courts of the United States, in the courts of Ecuador, and now in the courts of Argentina, Brazil, and Canada. So they've earned their day's pay, you know. They're, mm-hmm. they're entitled to a pretty good reward for all of that.
Tell me a bit about the Green Rights Project. It's multimedia, so there is a film, but like there's different components to this. This is sort of related to another reason why I'm interested in your career right now, is because you really you've sort of weathered the sea change that's happening in journalism already, where you know you've invented a new way to present stuff to people, a new way to present information and ideas, and you seem to be making it work. Tell me a bit about the components of the Green Rights Project and how they all fit together.
I wouldn't say we have weathered the storm, but I would say we are navigating the storm.
Yes, okay, right. Yes.
Well, I guess part of this goes back to exactly that issue. I mean, as a 20, 30 years ago, I could go to major national magazines and propose articles, get a decent rate of pay for them, and sustain myself, not lavishly, but satisfactorily, in a small village in Cape Breton. And that's the way I spent most of my life. But it's been very clear over the last few years that print media is I'm not sure that you could say it's in trouble, but it certainly isn't concentrated in the same sort of way. So you've got all kinds of people competing on the internet and publishing their own books and magazines going under, and advertisers not really knowing where to turn but deciding not to spend too much of it on print. So a tumultuous kind of situation. And it became clear to me that when the internet came along, that this was a huge game changer. This was a real cultural sea change. And that getting on somehow, making that one work for you was probably the key to the future. So that led to the Green Interview, which is a subscription website. So people, you know, pay a monthly fee to belong and to have access to the interviews. And then that got picked up by two organizations, one called Film on Demand and the other one that's been with us from the beginning, Gale Cengage. And they are library aggregators and educational aggregators. So they license the videos. Gale, for example, pays us a quarterly fee for each video. Now we're up to 60 videos, 60 interviews.
Hmm.
And so that's become... it's not a big amount of money, but it's enough to keep on rolling, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we had salmon wars. And salmon wars came out of the frustration of a lot of people, particularly salmon fishermen, but not only them, about the march of open net pen aquaculture up and down the coast. And one of the salmon fishermen called me up and said, you know, how can we keep this thing on the boil? I was still a columnist at the Halifax Herald at the time, and I'd written a column about it, and Henry called me up and said, what about this? So I said, I think we could do a documentary, and I think the documentary could be played in community halls, streamed off the internet. There are many different ways now to get a film out there. And he said, how much? And my colleague Chris Beckett and I worked up a budget, the smallest budget we could, and told him. And he said, I think we can raise that. And lo and behold, he and a couple of others went out and did raise it, you know. So a very untraditional way to produce a film. But once it was done, of course, then it was free. We didn't have to get any money back from it. So we could give it away. We raised some money, bought some DVDs, hand out DVDs. It streams off the internet. It's got its own site, salmonwars.com, and so on. So that led me to see, if we can do that on that small scale, why can't we do this on this large scale? If we can raise the money to make this film, then we can stream it on the internet, we can give it away, we can take it to film festivals, and to further pursue the multimedia thing, if we can find a broadcaster, which hasn't been easy, but if we can find a broadcaster, it could go on television just as well, and we'll make it in several lengths too, so there'll be like a 22-minute session or a version, which would be a television half hour, but would also be a nice length for classroom use. At the end of the day, I may wind up writing a book about it. Mm-hmm. So finally, we get back to print.
Back right? to your origins, back to your roots. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an interesting process. And for listeners who are interested in following the process of Green Rights, you have a website now, greenrights.com.
There are three websites, actually. There's greenrights.com, which is specifically devoted to this. There's the greeninterview.com, which is the long interviews. And there's a link on each one of them to the other. And then there's silverdonaldcameron.ca, which is me, and which is books and other articles and so forth.
Okay. Yeah. And there's blog posts and various things. So, you can sample and check out the various things that have been happening.
I tend to be a lousy blogger. What happens is I get terribly busy, and I think, oh, I should blog about this. I keep making notes on what I should blog about. And then I get a day or two, and I blog about everything all at once. The flood sort of pours out, and then nothing is heard from me for three more weeks, you know? But it does get done.
Yeah. Well, we're going to stay tuned to this project. Maybe we'll check back with you closer to finish time and hear more about the research that you've been doing.
It would be lovely. Where we're going from here is France is the first country in the world to have banned fracking, and that came out of Jacques Chirac getting environmental rights there, so we want to find out how that all happened. A wonderful Philippine lawyer named Antonio Oposa, we have one of our colleagues, actually, we may be interviewing him by long distance this week. And there's a swashbuckling guy named M.C. Mehta in New Delhi that has taken the government on and saves 4,000 lives a year by his work on air pollution, and has also saved the fabric of the Taj Mahal, which was being rotted by air pollution. So, yeah, we've got some more work to do, and we're having a wonderful time.
I bet. What is the situation in India with environmental rights? Where do they stand?
They are. They have a very powerful environmental rights set of environmental rights legislation, and it's been used by people like Mehta, and in quite remarkable ways. He sued the government to clean up the Ganges, the sacred Ganges, which had tanneries and all kinds of stuff dumping into it, and so forth. Won that one too. So there's a cleanup of the Ganges going on. And this is one guy, too. One of the lovely things about this is that so often these stories come down to the opportunity is there, the tools are there, and one person makes the decision that I would like to do this, and others kind of gather around that person. And here's the other one that's kind of amusing, which we have lawyers have such a bad rap in North America, but the leading figures in an awful lot of these things are lawyers of conscience, public service lawyers with NGOs, that mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know,
heroic lawyers.
Well, I mean, it is an adversarial kind of thing. So you know, if you want to have evil lawyers, you know, dressed in black, snickering on one side. You need to have the good guys too, right?
And it makes me think, if I were, I'm hoping that we'll get some real support from the legal profession, because, you know, if I had known stories like this when I was making a decision about where to go with my life in my early 20s, I might very well have gone to law school, you know? I mean, but I'd never thought of it as being a way of doing really good stuff in the world. But it is. It is.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, when you think of environmentalists, you know, working towards, they're constantly working towards, you know, changing legislation, getting regulations passed to just protect things, to keep it better. Always the big question comes right after, you know, even after a win, so a new regulation passed, but how do you enforce it, and all this kind of thing. With this, it's a different kind of situation, right? Like, I mean, I'm even thinking of our own Charter of Rights and Freedoms. I mean, just because we enshrined in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms that, you know, people couldn't be discriminated against, it wasn't as if it didn't happen overnight. Like, it just stopped, you know, in 1982 or whatever. That's not what happened. What happened is it gave people, citizens, the toolkit to say, no, now I can see where you're discriminating against me now, and this has to stop. But then people had to actually, so it's really, it's giving people a tool so that they can actually, so we can all sort of become enforcers for this idea.
And it's a statement of moral principle too. It's the country saying, we as a nation don't accept that kind of discrimination. And ultimately, this comes down to a kind of a cultural change, you know, so that it's not that you're enforcing these kinds of things over the objections of people. It's that you're gradually changing their minds so they see this as normal. I mean, the reason we have laws against murder is not because people are tempted to kill each other all the time. It's because we agree almost always, almost everyone, that you shouldn't do that, you know. And so that kind of change, you can see that in the environmental movement is the biggest movement in the history of the world. And it's facing some uphill battles precisely because it has become so effective. I mean, you look at the city of Halifax, we all sort our garbage. That's a decision that the people of Halifax made. They really did, through a process of consultation. So now that's the norm, and we don't have to have regulations about that. We all understand it. We all do it. It's become part of the way that our culture works. Well, that's happening across the board with environmental things, and I think this one is a vanguard position at the moment. But I think it's going to be, you know, conversations like this, and people will think about it and say, you know, that makes sense, and ultimately that will be the lens through which we look at the world. That's where this thing is finally leading, I think.
Silver Donald Cameron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Been my pleasure, absolutely.
Greenrights.com, thegreeninterview.com, and
SilverDonaldCameron.ca.
.ca.
Or .com, actually, either one will get you there.
Oh, nice. All right. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Habitat on CKDU 88.1 FM, habitatradio.ca, and rabble.ca/podcasts. Got feedback on the show? Call the CKDU feedback line at 494-8041 or email habitat@ckdu.ca or check us out on Twitter at Habitat Radio. I'm Erica Butler. Thanks for listening. Habitat.